Welcome to We Are History, and as the theme tune plays out and I push my keyboard to one side, Angela, what are we talking about today?
I'm just chuckling, John, because the way you said as the theme tune plays out, I thought, oh, he sounds like Nicholas Parsons, and then I remembered there is a job going there. Is this your audition?
Thank you for your intervention, Angela, which you enjoyed, and we'll give you an extra point. We have got to talk for 40 minutes without interruption, deviation or hesitation. About Stonehenge.
Stonehenge, that's right. Now, we made a little bit of a mistake here, didn't we, John?
Because I was going to have it on time, sir. Oh, it was going to be for the solstice.
We thought we'd do an episode on Stonehenge for the summer solstice. And what, I can't even say summer solstice. Summer solstice.
Summer solstice.
Summer solstice. That sounds like a terrible disease. but yeah, unfortunately, that was last week and we're recording it this week. But, you know.
Yeah, but, you know.
A week late's not bad for a pair of comedy writers.
Exactly. We love the sound, the deadlines. Oh, what's that joke? See, I'm getting that joke wrong as well as summer solstice.
It's a Douglas Adams quote, isn't it? Yeah, I love deadlines. I like the whooshing sound they make as they pass me by.
Oh, bless him. Bless Douglas Adams.
Absolutely.
So, Stonehenge. I'm going to lead on this one. I've read a very good book about it by Rosemary Hill, just called Stonehenge. But it's sort of a good summary of all the different historical takes on Stonehenge. Mm-hmm. A little bit of historiography this week, ooh, Angela. A history of the history.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of more fascinating. Well, it's what we know more about, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, the thing about Stonehenge is they didn't leave a lot of records.
No.
The planning application is no longer in Wiltshire County Council, if it ever was. So let's go back to the beginning. Stonehenge takes its name from Sir Alfred Stonehenge, who built it out of Lego in 1823.
Sounds legit.
Well, actually, there are many theories about as wrong as that one. Mm. Historians down the centuries believed it to be built for King Arthur. Merlin had it brought over from Ireland, apparently.
Presumably magicked over from Ireland.
Well, he was gifted in that way.
Yeah.
It was a Roman amphitheatre to some people. It was built by the Phoenicians, which is a weird one. They're Eastern European civilization.
Were they in Britain, the Phoenicians?
I don't think so. No.
Well, they just popped over for a holiday, built a henge and then buggered off again.
Built a dome.
Why not?
Built a centre parks. It was a Roman Buddhist temple. It was post-Roman. And then it was built by the Druids. And that one has stuck. And there's no evidence that the Druids were associated with it. But somehow it's managed to help create an entire modern movement based on one rubbish historian making shit up. So
we could start that now, couldn't we? Well, we could say that the Druids... You know, the Druids were planted a rose bush in my garden a couple of millennia ago.
It's now a temple, your garden.
That's now a temple.
You haven't got a garden, have you? You've got a balcony.
No, I've got a balcony. But they do a cracking hanging basket, the Druids.
It is weird, though, how some historical mistakes endure. And I think it's the image of their clothes and the gear. And it's just like Victorian romantics sort of like the idea of these old English Druids. And they sort of ran with it a bit.
Well, that's when it sort of came back to the forward sort of 18th century through the Victorians and to today, really, with the Druids.
One other mad theory about it is that it once had a wooden roof. Again, it was like a Millennium Dome or something.
Yeah.
But no one really knows what it was used for. Opinion is still divided on actually if it was ever finished.
Right.
They were building it for over 1,000 years, which seems like quite a long time.
I mean, imagine starting a project and then knowing you're never going to see it completed in your lifetime. I mean, I'm writing my first book at the moment, so I think I know what that feels like. But
it'll be 1,000 years time.
I'll just pass it on to the next generation. When they say, John, it was built over 1,000 years, do they mean that? Because I suppose you could say if you took a house that was built in the 20th century, obviously there's things underneath that. There might have been a homestead there before. So it's not the same... Yeah. Project necessarily, is it? It's just that
no, but I suppose there was a circle, an earthwork circle to start with, and then there were wooden posts, and then there were the stones, and then they moved the stones, and that process went on for over 1,000 years. Maybe the builder was just on another job,
right? Yeah,
maybe it was all like I've got this wood henge, I'm over there. So yeah, maybe it was just they're waiting for a skip or something. I don't know. But it was busy for about 1,000 years then. It was a religious site for 5, 6, 7, 8,000 years, possibly. When you think how long Christianity has been going, that is quite amazing, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised, in a way, that the Christians haven't tried to sort of take it over in some way, or have they at some point?
Well, there was a Victorian drawing in that book I mentioned, a Victorian sort of painting of the first Christianity being preached, you know, in England, and they set it at Stonehenge, right, as if those pagans were suddenly going, hang on a minute, oh, this guy's got it right. It's been patched up in recent years and stones have been moved and cemented into position. So what we now see is something that's been looking like it does since about 1964.
Right.
It's been a scheduled ancient monument since 1882.
Right.
And then a UNESCO World Heritage Site since 1986. And it's now owned by the Crown.
I think what I was really surprised at reading about it is I just assumed, so the first time I saw it was probably in the 80s, I guess, when I was a kid. And yeah, I just assumed that it looked like that forever. You know, I hadn't really realised, yeah, how much moving about and putting things back, yeah, and guesswork there was and recasting things in concrete and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's making up for modern accidents and stones blowing over. You know, they haven't sort of done it just for vanity's sake.
No.
They've made it, they've changed it because they want to get it back to how it was in the earliest etchings that we've seen. But it's, yeah, as I said, it's about 5,000 years old. The first original was an earthwork circle dug with antlers. Can you imagine that? That's not going to be easy.
Deer antlers.
Deer antlers, very hard, very hard. Especially if they're still attached to the deer.
I'm trying to think if there's any animal that might have been around that would be easier than that. Antlers seems very, cause they're sort of pointy, aren't they? But I suppose there's nothing else, is there? It's not like...
Well, you would have thought a flint axe or something.
Is that predates flint axes?
Maybe. It's the end of the Stone Age, really, that we're talking about. The Bronze Age comes along, I think, during this period. So that was Stonehenge 1. That's what the archaeologists call Stonehenge 1.
Right.
And then comes the sequel.
What did they call that, John?
Stonehenge 2.
The red fence.
This time, there's wood.
I mean, that sounds like a very different film, John.
Oh, your mind went straight there, didn't it? I'm shocked and shocked I am. Yeah, so they think there was wood there because there were lots of holes dug all around in a big circle. And they think that probably held wooden posts.
Okay. But the wood,
none of these,
doesn't last.
The wood has not survived. They didn't creosote. So.
Should have used Ron Seal. Does what it says on the tin.
Yeah, that was quick dry wood stain, Angela. Not creosote.
Was it? Is that not the same? I don't know.
I met that actor once. I met that actor.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah. He was in a sitcom that I'd written. And I had lunch with him and he goes, yeah, well, this gets me, you know, this keeps me going all year, really. And people shout out at me in the shopping centre. Does exactly what it says on the tin. But I don't mind. You know, it's my main income for me and my kids. And it's really sweet bloke. But he sort of set up for life, really, with this, just by going, does exactly what it says on the tin.
What it says on the tin.
But anyway, so yeah, Stonehenge 2, they found cremated remains in there. So they think it might have been some burial, have a burial function. Doesn't mean it was necessarily a mausoleum or built specifically for that purpose. People sprinkle their ashes, you know, have them at Old Trafford and, you know, the Emirates Stadium doesn't mean that's what it was built for, you know.
It's not a mausoleum. I'm always fascinated by, because I was reading about this, in the holes, like the wood holes, they found sort of rudimentary tools and like grave goods, basically, as well, don't they?
Yeah, what would you put in your...
Things that people have buried with. Well, this is, I mean, I did a whole two series on Radio 4 about this, so... but I'm always fascinated by what people are buried with.
Yeah.
Because I just think... For future archaeologists now, so my dad, for example, we buried with him all sorts of things when he died. We obviously, when he died, we didn't bury him alive with these things. That would have been cool.
That's
but
good
like
to,
we put in a
good to know.
Camping and caravanning magazine. My dad, the funeral directors had put his head on this beautiful lacy pillow, and it just didn't look like my dad at all. Oh, so I replaced it with a pair of inflatable boobs. So, but I just think of the archaeologist digging up his bones later and what they're going to find.
We believe that inflatable boobs were very important to this culture.
I found, I was doing my research for the show, I found that you can now buy coffins with drawers in.
Oh,
so
really?
That you can put people's goods they want to be buried with in the drawers. And on the website that sold them, it just said at the top, please remember, you will not get these items back.
Oh, my God.
I was like, he's doing that. Go, where are my keys? Oh, God. No.
I must have told you the story when I was at the funeral directors when my dad died. Have I told you that one on the podcast?
Don't think so.
So when me and my, you know, shell shock mother and my brother were at the funeral directors and we don't know what sort of coffin to have. And they go, well, there's three sorts. And they get down these wood samples, this sort of shoebox-sized coffin, and go, well, that's the mahogany, that's the most expensive. And we go, okay, okay. And then another little model, and they go, and that's the oak. That's moderately less expensive. And finally, this one is the pine, another shoebox-sized coffin. They're all lying there on the table, and I just turned to her and went, see, think about these are all much too small. And my mum, she laughed so much, I thought she was going to have a heart attack. We'll get a two for one deal. But the great thing was, the poor undertaker was not allowed to laugh at all. He kept a completely straight face, and he was like,
"They're so well trained,
aren't they?" He was like, "Oh no, we have to respect the this. You know, grief manifests itself in many different ways."
While we're on this, just a quick one. Yeah. When my dad died, I went to the funeral directors and they said, do you know which minister you want to do the service? Because my dad was an atheist,
right.
But he wanted to be cremated where his father was. And so you needed a Church of England minister to do the service. So I said, I don't know any. So they gave me a list of names of ministers that were local. And the first one was Reverend Joe King. I swear to God. And I was like, well, obviously it's him. We're having him.
So you went to him. You are joking.
You are joking. And he opened the sort of service by saying, I know I got this gig because of my name and it's what Derek would have wanted. That's and good. I was like, absolutely.
So who knows? Who knows if what they put? That's, no, one. Me too. It was like tools and things they put in, weapons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like blowpipes and little axe heads and things like that.
Yeah, weirdly, around this time, the Egyptians were building the pyramids. So sort of puts Stonehenge into perspective a bit when you think about Tutankhamun's golden face at the same time as bits of old deer antlers digging a trench. It wasn't until around 2600 BC that finally we got Stonehenge 3. It's a trilogy. It's like Godfather.
It's going to be like Fast and Furious. Yeah. They keep going.
Stonehenge 3, and then that's when they erected the stone circle.
So the stones weren't there from the beginning?
No, it was a big earth circle and a big wooden circle, we think.
Wooden circle.
One thing around the same time, this was the Beaker people around this time. You've heard of the Beaker people, I'm sure.
Beaker people? Yes, I have indeed.
They were so named for their beakers.
Right. It does seem strange. I'm sorry, John, but every time I think of the Beaker people, all I hear is Beaker from the Muppets.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And when I was reading about this, I just ended up on a YouTube spiral of watching clips from the Muppet Show. So I just imagine these people like, me, 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 me.
Well, anyway, Beakers, the Beaker people were mad for their Beakers. Every Christmas, every birthday, it was, well, guess what I've got you, darling? Oh, wonder what it is.
Oh, is it a Beaker?
Oh, it's another bloody Beaker. I'll put it with the other ones.
Oh, that means in my house we'll be the scented bloody candle people.
They
then.
Were
That's
the scented
we'll
candle people. But alcohol was a new thing at this point. So maybe they put alcohol in the beakers, you know. And then they got drunk and then they said, oh, let's build a massive stone circle.
I've had more stupid ideas than that when I've had a few. So, yeah.
Next morning. What? Oh, God. Do we have to go through with this?
Did we tell Dave we'd build a massive stone circle?
And it's weird that this is the beginning of the Bronze Age. So it might be the old gits going, stone is better. We're going to show you, you young lads with your bronze. You watch what we can do with stone.
Can you do this with bronze?
I don't think so.
Is there a bronze henge? No.
Exactly. So they started to erect these amazing stones on Salisbury Plain. Probably around 80 stones, they reckon, originally, which 43 can be traced today.
Well, you need a lot of tracing paper, John.
Angela, leave the podcast for five minutes.
I'm sorry.
Go and sit down.
I'm sorry. Let's let the listener. We are recording this on the hottest day of the year, and my brain is a puddle right now.
We're doing it remotely. We're doing it in lockdown. Yeah. We're doing it in a heat wave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know that those really big stones, the ones that make the three, you know, the goal mouth. They were quite local. They were from Marlborough Downs. Everyone thinks those were from Wales, but it was the smaller stones that came from the Presilly Hills in South Wales.
How did they get them there?
We don't know. We think they may have used rafts to float them across the River Severn, the Severn Estuary. To avoid the tolls on the Severn Bridge.
There aren't any tolls there anymore, John.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, they've gone now.
One Victorian and historian suggested they used mammoths. They trained mammoths to haul them across, which doesn't sound very likely. So we think they were dragged across by huge teams. So it sounds impossible to move a sort of, you know, 15-ton slab of stone. I'm guessing that weight, actually.
The thing is, I guess when you're researching things that are prehistory with no written records, you do end up with more questions than answers.
Well, that's what's interesting about Stonehenge, really. It's like, it's an enigma, Angela. It's an enigma.
Yeah, because it's not like there's no rocks in Wiltshire.
No.
Why did they have to bring them from...
The special ones,
Wales.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we got the smaller ones, the Saracens, come from Wales. There was a group that got some funding from the lottery to recreate this act using only Bronze Age, Stone Age methods.
Oh, like, sorry, you mean like a modern
group? Sorry,
like
there was a modern group that decided to... I've got their name written down here.
Like, they had the lottery.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, no, it goes back. It was the Mentir Pezzelli group. And they got like 100 grand, I think, to move similar rocks a similar distance using only prehistoric methods. Then the health and safety executive said they had to wear gloves.
And they probably had the same problem in the Bronze Age.
Exactly, Bronze Age health and safety. And then they put them on rafts across the Severn, presuming that's what they did. And their rafts tipped over and the rocks sank to the bottom of the Severn estuary. So you're laughing, Angela. You can imagine how annoying.
Just watching 100 grand sink to the bottom of the Severn estuary isn't funny. But
oh, God. Yeah, it would have been awful, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So it was hard. You know, what they did was an incredible achievement back then. They didn't just plonk up any old rocks, you know, they're carefully designed. They taper slightly. The inward sides are smoother and more worked than the rougher outer facing sides. Mm-hmm. The trithlons have mortise and tenon joints, which is not very typical for...
That's the tabletop thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
Trilithon? Trilithon.
Trilithon.
Sounds like something my fella would try and do, a trilithon.
That's right. You have to swim, run, and then climb Stonehenge.
Yeah, exactly.
So they had mortise and tenon joints on them. They've got a tongue and groove method was also used, which what we all learned in woodwork.
You say we all, John. I'm a woman. We didn't have woodwork at my school.
Was it needlework? School. Was it?
I didn't think I was that old, but yeah, still in the 90s, you had to do textiles, not woodwork.
God, terrible, wasn't it? Changed now, I think.
Yeah, I hope so.
But they really had thought about the overall effect. They've been designed, I suppose, is what I'm saying. So there must have been an architect.
Yeah.
You know, he probably had big blue glasses and a ponytail. there would have been, you know, they thought about the overall impression when you saw them from the distance.
Well, there must have been some level of engineering involved for them to have stayed standing
for quite a bit.
Yeah. Yes. They didn't just lob them up there, did they?
No, but you can actually see mistakes that they did at the time where they'd put a mortise and tenon that they ended up not using or whatever.
Right.
So there's places where they went wrong and sort of fixed it. But yeah, they took the overall visual effect into account, the slight slope of the ground, left some space for the gift shop and the car park that will come later.
It's nice of them.
Once they got it all in position, it seems like they moved things around again. So the smaller stones got moved. Maybe they'd been there for a while and go, ever since we moved in here, I've never really liked the way those little stones are there. Jeff, can we have those moved around a bit?
So it sounds like living with my nan who wanted to redecorate and have her furniture moved like every year, basically. And my granddad took to... Yeah. Because she'd be, we haven't decorated this room in decades. And he'd be like, we did it 2 years ago. So what he used to do is before we put new wallpaper up, he'd write the date underneath the wallpaper.
So, oh, it's like a
so
show.
She made him take it down.
It
and
back.
He'd go, see? That's when we did it.
That's good. So, yeah, they moved the smaller stones around a bit. Middle class has moved in, knocked it through into one. But the second time, they didn't dig them in as well. And they start to fall over.
Right.
So they had to get the builder back. God, you've had some cowboys in here. Who done this then?
Well, there's one theory, isn't there, that the smaller one is a sort of model for the bigger one, that they kind of did a... And all I can think about when I think of a smaller Stonehenge is Spinal Tap.
There's so many cultural references about Spinal Tap, but just since we're there, let's just talk about Spinal Tap.
Oh, my God.
Anyone who hasn't seen the film, it's a sort of heavy metal, a sort of mockumentary, and he writes down on a sort of beer mat, they want to have this massive Stonehenge come lower onto the stage when they're in concert, and he writes down the dimensions he wants it, but he puts two little lines for inches instead of one little line for feet.
He says 18 feet, wasn't it? But he puts 18 inches.
So they're playing this guitar solo or whatever, and Stonehenge is lowered behind them, but it's 18 inches high. But the brilliant thing about this is it's true. It sort of virtually happened the other way round. So between them filming that scene and the film being released, Black Sabbath did the Born Again tour. Mm. And what a Black Sabbath went, I want Stonehenge behind. I want it full size behind. And they didn't go, well, let's just see how big full size is, because that's going to be... So they ordered it full size. It wouldn't fit in any of the trucks. and it took about three lorries. And they built this thing that was completely useless for the Born Again tour. Amazing that happened exactly as where they were filming.
And that was before the film came out.
Yeah, but after they filmed the scene.
That's incredible. Yeah.
That's in Rosemary Hill's
book. One of my favourite bits in the whole film is the bit afterwards when he says, when the manager goes, let's not make a big thing of it. He went, oh, we should have made a big thing of it.
Oh, dear. Excellent. Oh. But anyway, the big discovery, or rediscovery, I should say, in 18th or 19th century was the fact it had an astrological aspect to it. That, yeah, I mean, this is the big deal with Stonehenge, that the rising sun on the solstices, and the winter and summer. On those days, you're standing in the middle of the circle and it aligns with the heel stone, which is outside the circle, almost perfectly, but not quite. So there's a theory that there might have been two little stones there and it rose in the gap between them.
Between them. Yeah. John?
Yes? Like,
the heel stone obviously is significant because that's where the sun rises.
Yes.
But it's a stone circle, right? So the sun is going to rise on one of the stones because it's a circle. So would that one not be significant? Is it not just a coincidence? Could it not be?
No, because there's a whole avenue down there. I mean, it's not just a stone plonked on the outside. Right. The whole thing is aligned along this...
along that line. That, right, okay. Because I was just thinking, yeah, if it's a stone circle, then surely wherever the sun rises, it's going to hit a stone, right?
Yeah, but June 20th and December the 20th, those are significant dates in the astrological year.
Yeah.
And it's in perfect alignment.
Yeah.
So it's not. I don't think that's an accident. So they were obviously a society that were very interested in, probably worshipped the sun and the stars. Maybe they were massively into astrology. Who knows? They were like, oh, Pisces, this is a good week for you. You're going to catch a mammoth.
I don't believe in all that, but then I'm a very typical Scorpio. So.
Ba-dum-tsh. It's got to be done.
I'm ashamed of myself.
Good, it's got to be. You've got to finish. Always in practice, you know, always do the punchline, whatever. Just tap it away in the back of the net. I'm going to plough on with this. You just keep doing stupid jokes. Some of the stones had carvings on them. They discovered quite late on, a dagger, an axe and some Bronze Age weapons.
There was a Flemish painter in the 16th century who did a famous watercolour of Stonehenge. And he apparently carved his name on stone 53. His name was Lucas de Heer. So I guess it says Lucas was here. What no gift shop or something like that. I don't know. But yeah, he carved his... That name on it.
That wasn't uncommon back in the day. And people used to, when the Victorians used to visit, they'd all turn up with a little hammer and chisel and chop little bits off to take
home.
I mean, I've got a little bit of Berlin Wall here in my drawer.
I was going to say, everyone's got... Do you know what? If you added together everyone who's got a little bit of the Berlin Wall...
This is the Berlin Wall.
50 Berlin Walls.
This is genuine Berlin Wall.
Did you chip it off yourself?
I haven't... Mark did. So we know that it was an active religious site for 3,000 or 4,000 years. There's a body buried there that they found in around 2400 BC called the Stonehenge Archer.
God, I knew the archers had been going a long time, John. I didn't know it was that long. Hey? Is he a relative of the Brookfield archers, was he? Hey?
He was actually Swiss. So they found out from his DNA. So what he was doing visiting with a bow and arrow near Stonehenge is anyone's guess.
Well, he's Swiss with a bow and arrow. I'm saying he was probably an ancestor of William Tell.
The apple has not survived. But it's interesting that some Swiss bloke would come to Stonehenge. It's also, they know that people from Scotland came to Stonehenge. Thousands, they reckon, came for the solstice. They found animal remains that would have been enough to feed many, many people. And the livestock had come from Scotland.
Last people I thought would be out worshipping the sun would be the Scots.
Well, yeah, I suppose they're thinking, oh, you go down to Wiltshire, get a bit more sunshine. It's basically a great big Glastonbury festival at the time.
I bet the loos were better than today's.
So, yeah, and it was a big, massive party every solstice. And this carried on for thousands of years. And then around 1600 BC, it all goes quiet. No more remains, no more archaeological evidence. When the Romans came, they completely ignored it. No mention of it anywhere.
So there's no evidence of any Roman presence there at all?
No, they had no interest in it.
Wow.
And so the records disappear and dry up. And at that point, why don't we take an interval?
Yes.
And then we'll come back for the modern interpretations, the disputed ownership, the World Heritage, and an excuse for the police to beat up a load of hippies.
I'm in.
See you after the break. Welcome back. Welcome back to We Are History. We had a beaker of mead, didn't we?
Indeed we did.
Drank to our gods. It's just if you're doing old...
Sorry, I can only think of beaker from the Muppets every time you say it.
If you're talking about the olden days, just say gods in the plural and it makes it sound like you know what you're talking about.
Right, yes.
They would have given thanks to their gods.
And what were their gods' names, John?
Oh, I don't know about then. Maybe Beaker was one of them. Yeah, we're looking at the sort of Stonehenge in modern times now. So the cultural representations of Stonehenge, too many to list. There's a great Turner watercolour. There's a painting by Constable and Blake. Thomas Hardy set the ending of Tess of the D'Urbervilles there. Did you ever do that book for GCSE or anything, Angela?
No, we did Return of the Native.
Ah, yes. I know someone who went from, when Rhodesia was called Rhodesia, they went from South Africa to Rhodesia and had Return of the Native confiscated because they thought it was a, it was like, what's this Return of the Native? That sounds like a communist book.
Oh my God. Brilliant.
I did do Tess of the D'Urbervilles and I was very struck at the time by her sleeping on the slaughter stone or the whatever it was and the police arriving from all directions and standing in a circle around Tess. In fact, their pointy helmets are a bit like the heel stone.
Yeah.
And she's left to sleep there. Angel begs that she's allowed to sleep. And then she's arrested when they finally turn up. When Polanski made his film, of course, he couldn't do it in England because he was would have been arrested.
Had he already been? Yeah.
So he did it in France. And they had to rebuild Stonehenge in Brittany.
Luckily, Black Sabbath had one in their truck that he could borrow. Yeah.
Maybe that was it.
He did a deal. It's fine.
So as I say, it became this sort of popular place to visit. And when the French Revolution happened and the European tour no longer became an option because we're at war with Napoleon or whatever, people designed tours of Britain.
Right.
And Stonehenge was very much on that list. And they had this problem that when you approach Stonehenge, I don't know if you remember this, but if you approach Stonehenge from a long way off, it looks a bit small.
Yeah.
So what they would do is for the Victorians or the Georgians riding up in their carriages, they'd say, keep the blinds down. Then you took the blinds up when you're right next to it and you went, gasp, look at it, it's marvellous.
You could have your ta-da.
Exactly, it was a bit of a ta-da moment.
It does look, I spend a lot of time looking at Stonehenge from the A303 because if every time I'm gigging in the West Country, yeah. I end up stuck on that bloody road for hours.
Yeah.
And it does, from the road, it doesn't look that
impressive. No,
I mean it's still quite impressive from the road, but until you get up close and personal it is just like, oh, it's a pile of rocks.
Yeah, my mum used to always on long holidays to Cornwall, my mum would always wake us up and go, look, oh, it's Stonehenge, darling. I was asleep, mum.
Yeah.
But also it's always a traffic jam because everyone slows down as they go past, apart from anything else.
I remember being in a traffic jam by Stonehenge and at the same time there was a wasp in my car. I just remember that, the real panic moment of
well, that's what you associate Stonehenge with.
Yeah.
So anyway, in the 1700s, architect John Wood did a very comprehensive survey of Stonehenge. He was the first one to really map it out and lay it out in such great detail. And he was greatly inspired by it. And when he laid out bits of London after that, he took the circular theme and gave us Piccadilly Circus and Oxford Circus. And these circuses and the British predisposition to roundabouts sort of comes from John Wood and his love of Stonehenge.
He's got a lot to answer for, that bloke. Have you been to Swindon?
Next time you're stuck at a mini roundabout. So it's those bloody druids, or not druids, with their Stonehenge.
Not druids, whoever they are.
Yeah. So,
do you know, in my family are from Newfoundland.
That's right.
In Canada. I might have mentioned that on the podcast before, probably have. And we were there in September, and in St. John's, the capital, they've just got their first ever roundabout. And it's hilarious because no one knows how to use it. And because they're so polite and lovely, everyone gives way at every exit.
That's hilarious.
So it's just carnage. Everyone's just stopping and it just takes ages to get round it. Yeah. It's really funny.
Yeah, no, we are. It is a particularly British thing. We do love our roundabouts and it's all thanks to Stonehenge. Oh, no. In fact, when they were doing the ongoing debate about dealing with the roads, the A303 and that other one, there's a junction there, one of the nuttier suggestions was to make the monument the centre of a big traffic roundabout. So that would have been a fantastically British solution, wouldn't it?
That's perfect. An archaeologist of the future would be like, and obviously this is where they put one of their roundabouts that they revere so much. It would have made perfect sense.
A roundabout managed by the Wiltshire Youth Offenders Team.
Yeah.
So in 1824, the land was built by the Antrobus family and they refused to let anyone dig at Stonehenge, which is probably just as well. Because given the Victorian sort of vandalistic tendencies, they probably would have...
Yeah, they weren't careful with monuments, were they, the Victorians? They weren't delicately brushing things and...
No, they're like, I'll take that back for my garden, you know.
Yeah.
It's good enough for the marbles and for bits of pyramids. I'll have that and all. Mm. People still visited, of course, and they walked around. They slid down the fallen stones. You would do it if you're a kid. This is pretty boring, isn't it?
Well, I mean, to a kid, I remember going there as a kid and couldn't understand why I wasn't allowed to climb on it.
Yeah.
Because it is just a climbing frame if you're a kid, right?
Exactly. Everything's a climbing frame. So, yeah, the Victorians carried on shipping bits off and, like you say, attempted to carve their initials. There was a pub down the road called the Druid's Head.
Of course it was.
Which stayed open all night, and their drunken parties used to go out and see the solstice at dawn, and the police had to keep order, apparently. So it was, even the Victorians were a load of drunks there.
Well, that's, I love the start of the Druid movement, really, in this country, or who made it. So this George MacGregor Read,
yeah.
Did you read about him?
Yeah, yeah.
He's apparently fantastic. The guy who also invented Sinatogen. And he sort of, he interpreted all of this as the Druids as being the first original faith, and that Stonehenge was its prime site in Britain, and that the Britons were sort of interpreting this faith that was a universal world faith. And yeah, he, in the sort of early 1900s, he got into loads of trouble, didn't
he? Yes, was it him who founded one of the, several of them, but there's the Secular Order of Druids, which was abbreviated to SOD.
Brilliant. And I think he was the Universal Bond of the Sons of Men, was him, who had their headquarters in Clapham, John.
Oh, they might if they're still there.
And apparently they'd hold their ceremonies in Clapham and then they'd all move together down to Stonehenge.
Well, it's quite a long way to Stonehenge.
Blimey. Yeah.
The Victorian sort of, there was a sort of romantic Druid movement in the Victorian age, all built from one sort of rubbish historian sort of a couple of hundred years earlier. Very last day of the century, the 31st of December 1899, there was a terrible storm and one of the largest stones blew over.
Mm.
And they say that Queen Victoria died soon afterwards. But I don't think she'd happened to have been
standing
by
under
the
it.
that would have been too much. It was a coincidence that she died, I think.
You think, but we anyway, might have learned about that at school if that had happened.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of a John Brown pushing her in a wheelchair. And, but anyway, the Antrobus family, they eventually put up a fence and they started charging people. And there was huge outrage. And they sold it to somebody called Cecil Chubb.
It was after they died, didn't they? Because I think Sir Edmund Antrobus, who sort of was the one who put up the fences and charged all the admissions and stuff. I think he had one son, but his son died in the war, in the First World War.
That's right.
So he couldn't inherit it. And I think when Edmund died, it got sold. I think Cecil Chubb bought it for £6,000, I think it was.
Right.
In 1915. Then he gifted it to the nation 3 years later. Hurrah.
You'd think, great, finally, because people for 100 years have been saying this should belong to all of us.
Yeah.
But it didn't start well. So in 1928, they built the Stonehenge Cafe right next door. There was a bungalow built there. I don't know if that was a caretaker's or whatever. The car park followed in 1935. There was turnstiles, iron railings, an abandoned aerodrome. And then Salisbury Plain was a big military HQ.
Well, this is just post-World War One, is it? In World War One, it was a big military HQ. Like you said, in fact, it was a World War One pilot flying over who spotted Woodhenge.
That's right.
Which is the other henge just up the road.
The other henge nearby.
I've been to Woodhenge. I've got photos of me in Woodhenge because I went on this.
You live an exciting life.
Well, I'll tell you this. I went on a holiday when I was 14. We went on a holiday to Wiltshire. It was with my auntie and uncle who were had slightly hippie-ish tendencies, but not massively. And their two sons and me, I was 14. One of their sons was older than me, one younger. And on this holiday, loads of weird stuff came. And this was in 1991. And it was at the height of the crop circle thing, stuff that was going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So my auntie had been reading a lot about this stuff before we went on this holiday to Wiltshire. So she was all into the ley lines and all of that stuff. Oh, yeah. You know, we went to Stonehenge, we went to Woodhenge and had a look around. And we were staying in this little cottage. And I swear to God, we woke up one morning and there was just a cornfield outside the window and there was a corn circle in it.
Wow.
And me and my cousin, who was 2 years younger than me, who was 12, we freaked out, completely freaked out. Because we'd been reading all this stuff, and this is before those hoaxes had come forward. You know, people were saying it was aliens or it was, you know, some sort of communication
freak
with another
winds
planet.
Or something.
Whatever it was. Whatever it was, I shat myself. And
So
my
metaphorically.
And that night I was really frightened, like properly frightened to sleep.
Yeah. Some aliens are gonna come down and kidnap
and
you.
And so my cousin who was older, he must have been about 20 at that time, I think. So my auntie and uncle had gone out and he was babysitting me and my younger cousin. And he got me drunk on Tia Maria to calm me down. It's the first time I've ever been properly drunk. So then I was frightened and puking Tia Maria. that night as well. But yeah, that's what Woodhenge did to me. I blame the ley lines.
If you've been upset by any issues in this podcast, phone our helpline and free phone Woodhenge. Angela's shitting herself on Tia Maria.
I've got a photo of the corn circle somewhere. I know, even though I know rationally, you know, some human beings came and did, it was really mad that it appeared outside my bedroom window where I'd been sleeping that night. I heard nothing. I mean, I am deaf, but you know.
Yeah, that is
and then
weird, isn't it? Yeah.
We'd been talking about all this stuff and just woke up the next morning and there was one in the field next to us. It really freaked me out.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
A few years before that, in about 83 or 84, I was a student at Exeter doing drama, and we got wind that there was going to be a production of The Tempest at Stonehenge. So we went up to Wiltshire with our beaten up old Ford Escort and some homemade beer, flagons of homemade beer. And this was when it was a lot of tension between the hippies police and the New Age. So we tried to watch this performance of The Tempest, but all behind them the whole time, the security forces really pissed off this was happening. I don't know if it had all been cleared or whatever. They were just walking around the back of the stage with Alsatians and torches and stuff. And it was like, you know, Caliban or whatever is trying to do his speech and there's some out-of-work prisoner officer with his Alsatian upstaging him completely.
I can remember it being on the news when I was young, the sort of clashes at Stonehenge every solstice. I can remember that being a news thing. You know.
Well, it was a great clash between people who believed in its... Whatever you think about the Druid thing, these people, it was obviously important to them. There was this, the trouble was that it was a Stonehenge, you know, there became a free festival site in the 70s. And you said the people would sort of spill over from Glastonbury and be another free festival down the road. Thousands of hippies, 30,000 people there 1 year. And the monument couldn't take that much wear and tear, and the infrastructure wasn't there. So it was very heavy-handedly put down.
Solstices.
And in the run-up to, I think it was 85, so at the end of the miners' strike,
and nothing
the police
to do.
Had a bit of a taste for violence. Well, no, but they'd sort of got away with all the violence of the miners' strike, and all these hippies decided to sort of, I think one bus tried to crash a police barrier or something. But anyway, the police completely set about these hippies, beat them senseless with their truncheons in this bean field. And the Earl of Cardigan, who was the some local landowner, was a president of the local Conservative Association, he gave evidence in court saying how poorly
the police
had behaved. Against the police. He was saying, I would say what I saw. And if a woman is lying on the ground, you don't expect a policeman to beat her around the head with a truncheon. And it was a very, very ugly scene. And I think it was the sort of lowest point, really, in our sort of modern history of Stonehenge, that it had come to this, that people who wanted to go there and worship and celebrate the solstice were being beaten up.
Such a period, wasn't there, in the 80s of violent policing. From the miners' strike through to Hillsborough, you know, all that stuff that encompasses. Yeah. It's such an intense period of...
Well, Hillsborough was incompetence, really, rather than violence. Yeah, but there was a student demo where the police really beat them up, and there was I think it's what they had such free rein during
the
Thought
they could get away with anything.
Exactly. So in 89, English Heritage had put up razor wire, and there were searchlights, and it was all very heavy-handed. But one rather heroic bloke changed his name to Arthur Pendragon, and he would dress in flowing robes, and he just got arrested over and over again. And he was charged with possession of an offensive weapon because he'd bought the sword prop from the film Excalibur. So he said, "This is Excalibur. I am Arthur Pendragon." All right, you've had your laugh. Come on. But then when the police arrested him, he tried to citizens arrest the policeman as King Arthur. So I'm sure that went down well.
I wish somebody had filmed that. That would be
That's before we all had phones. But after about the year 2000, I think Chris Smith, the culture secretary, realised that it was important to people and people should be allowed to be there for the solstice. Actually, the more significant solstice, and I think it lines up better, is the winter solstice.
Right. Not as much fun, though, is it?
It wants to be there, you know, in the freezing cold fog and you can't see
drizzling
anything.
Drizzling and, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So it's summer solstice. So that darkest period of the 80s and 90s sort of passed. But it's, you know, this new age thing, it runs deep. And there's people like your auntie and that who believe in ley lines and earth energy and all that stuff.
It does seem to be a lot, though, concentrated in that area, doesn't there? There's got to be something that has concentrated if it's just a coincidence. But
well, it's where the Iron and Bronze Age people lived, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess.
Sorry, Stone and Bronze Age. Weirdly, the designers of Milton Keynes were really into all this stuff. Right. They wanted to do the boulevards along ley lines, which they ultimately couldn't do because there's no such thing. but they named, this is true, they named the main streets Silbury, Avebury and Midsummer Boulevard.
Really?
On the morning of the summer solstice, the rising sun shines directly through the shopping centre and its rays strike a sculpture and a branch of John
Lewis. I love that. I sort of love that marriage of Milton Keynes being, you know, a brutalist monstrosity new town and a hippie centre. Like, what a beautiful marriage of two things.
Yeah, I know, that's funny,
yeah,
isn't it?
Lovely.
So, yeah, the modern story of Stonehenge has been this, you know, attempt to keep everyone happy. Mm. All the, you know, National Trust and English Heritage, New Age hippies,
Druids.
The police, Druids, exactly. So it's impossible. Mm. So they tried to suggest moving the road, making a tunnel out of the road. £25 million has been spent the past 20 years on proposed tunnels and plans. Moving the road a little bit nearly was going to happen, but then they realised that would destroy the habitat of the Des Moulins whirl snail, which is a very rare snail. The Des Moulins whirl snail, whorl. It would appear that for all these plans, Angela, and all these bureaucrats, they seem to have been going round in circles.
Oh, John. Oh, hang on. Let me...
Hello. Oh,
Bravo.
That's very good.
Bravo, John.
I thank you. So we're not going to get much better than that. But it's a great iconic international symbol. There's an artist in Mexico who made Fridgehenge.
Amazing.
Who ranged fridges in the desert with a sun rising in line with a heel fridge.
Beautiful.
When I was in New York last summer, I learned there's a thing called Manhattan Henge.
Right.
When there was one day of the year when the sun rises in perfect line between the skyscrapers. If you look along sort of 50th Street or something, it's only a certain time of the year that the sun rises right up or sets between them. And the whole crowds gather and people cheer. And it's great.
That's lovely.
I'm sure the builders of Stonehenge never imagined that one day they'd be inspiring New Yorkers to applaud the sun going down between skyscrapers.
Yeah, but they were aliens, weren't they, John, from the future?
They were aliens from the future. This has been established by various dodgy books in the 1970s by Eric von Daniken.
Oh, God bless him.
And, Stonehenge, an enigma, but a very interesting one.
Yeah.
Go down there, have a visit. Take a little hammer and chisel so you can keep yourself
fit.
Have a slide down it. It's a climbing frame for the kiddies. In fact, there is one at Alton Towers. There's a model that the original Earl of Shrewsbury built himself a sort of little replica as a sort of folly in his garden. Before Alton Towers was a theme park, when it was just a great country estate, that he built himself a little Stonehenge. So there's still a bit there if you do go to
Alton Towers. Something about images of Stonehenge that feels very... comforting is not the right word, but it is very... It's such a British thing, isn't it? And it does feel very sort of... Oh, yeah. So it's so instantly recognisable to any British person.
Yes. And it was rather sort of... There's a sort of wonderful sort of symmetry to the fact that Microsoft used Stonehenge as its standard wallpaper for a decade or so. When you turned on your computer, there was Stonehenge on the screen.
Right.
And you think, well, we've come a long way.
Oh, have we? Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I mean, I'd like to say there we are, we've covered Stonehenge, but it's impossible, right, John?
It's impossible. No one knows anything about it, but it makes it all the more fascinating.
Absolutely.
Go down there at midwinter and wait for the sun to rise in the freezing snow and the fog, and it's too cloudy and you won't see anything. That's all from We Are History.
Do give us a little follow on Twitter at We Are History Pod. We are making a note of all your lovely suggestions and we will hopefully get around to all of them eventually.
Give us 6 stars.
Yes, if you could.
And it goes up to 5, but we'll meet you halfway. And we'll catch you next week on We Are History. Thanks for listening and just tell your friends.
Bye.
Bye.